Hi everyone, this is Serhat. My guest today at the Curious Learners is Sebastian Mannhardt. He is the Senior Policy Advisor at Carbon Future, which is the operating system for high-quality carbon removals. Hi Sebastian, welcome to the Curious Learners.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
I've been exploring this idea of technology outpacing regulation and policy, and the pace of penetration might be different, you know, based on how regulators and governments would react to it and how they view it. And, you know, given your experience in this space, which we will talk about on the show today, what framework, what mental model do you use to interpret that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, you're starting off straight away with kind of one of my biggest passions, which is the intersection of technology and policy government. And I think the first thing that I should state straight away is I don't believe anything can scale to a significant size without these two collaborating closely. And in my time, I've kind of seen both sides. Now in the climate space, and hope we're going to talk about it, I see a lot of convergence between the two. I actually see a lot of collaboration. I spent 2 years in the crypto space working on identity, and there I saw a big gap between the two. So you'll always have technology pacing ahead. I think that's inevitable. Innovation, technology is always going to be pacing ahead. That's a healthy dynamic. But unless there's a clear link to government and policy, it just won't get very far. But again, that's just what I've seen in the market.
You were an advisor to German government on digital decentralized identity. And what was your takeaway from the time that you spent there? What's your observation of how these people view new frontier technology?
This was one of the most interesting jobs I could ever wish for. And I got to spend the last 1.5 years of Merkel's long chancellery in her office. And I guess besides kind of learning from her and from her team and seeing how government worked, what I really took away to answer your question was the lack of technical skills and knowledge in government. And I think this is something that you see across the board, and it's systemic. There might be some governments that break out of it, but I mean, I could spend a podcast talking about why governments cannot manage to recruit the right technical staff. Again, there's structural systemic reasons for that. And that's not really going to change, which means we really need to think about how can a government make the right decisions when it comes to tech without having this experience. How do they do it? By partnering with the private sector, by partnering with technology companies. That's why I think crypto is so complicated, because you don't have an effective link between the two. Whereas in the climate space, I see a lot of links between the two. And as technology producers, as innovators, we really have to be proactively thinking, how can we bring capacity into government? Because if we don't do it, what I've seen happening is governments hire, you know, big consulting firms on very big budgets as experts in whatever technologies they need. And they then make big architectural, structural decisions, strategic decisions that I don't think are particularly well informed. So yeah, we need to close that gap and make sure that technology makes its way into the government.
And now that we went right into it in the first few minutes of the podcast, how about we take a step back and hear more about your background? What's your journey coming into advising on policy?
Yeah, so my background is actually, I'm a trained economist. I studied at UCL and Cambridge and also stint in Harvard. And I loved the economics of things, which is also why I love kind of market dynamics, carbon credits, all of that. But actually, I spent around 10 years as an entrepreneur, a tech entrepreneur. You know, my first very unsuccessful company is when I was 18, 19, then increasingly more successful, thankfully. And I guess the most interesting and biggest one that I helped scale to around 50, 60 people was a company called Simprints, which was developing technology to increase transparency in the aid sector, which again is a $200 billion a year industry that is fraught, you know, with a lot of corruption, a lot of problems. So we were developing technology for it. From there, I got asked to join the chancellery. I transitioned to startup. I went to work with Angela Merkel's team until her term ended. And then I also kept working with governments through the World Bank. But really, I've kind of started as an entrepreneur and then increasingly moved into policy. And those are my two passions now. And so when I thought about what doing next, I saw these two options. But why I chose policy is there are a lot of great entrepreneurs that I see around me, especially in the climate tech space. There's so many great entrepreneurs. In the policy space, there's less people. And I think there's less really kind of good entrepreneurially thinking people. And so I just realized I could make the biggest dent if I chose the policy side for the future.
If you maybe go one level down to help me understand, you know, day to day, how does your interaction work really with the teams? Can you wipe that a little bit? In what practical ways being an entrepreneur for over a decade helps you advising on policy to these founding teams?
I mean, a bunch of things. The first one is, I get that you don't have perfect information. And I think for a startup, that's probably even more so than for bigger companies. And so I'm happy to operate with limited information and still move fast. And I think that's something that probably founding teams appreciate because it's utterly necessary. The second thing I think is just prioritization. As an entrepreneur, you learn that it's not just that there are fires burning at all times, but actually that you need to let them burn. And the challenge is, what fires do you let burn and which ones do you extinguish? And I think many people who are not from the entrepreneurial background find it very uncomfortable to know there's a fire burning and not touch it. But that's, again, that's day to day for any entrepreneur, right? And I think that's very helpful when working with a founding team. And now Carbon Future is just appreciating that there will always be fires. And I think the last thing, this is more for the policy work, entrepreneurial kind of approaches to policy are quite rare. And what do I mean with that? I mean, kind of, you know, being proactive, just getting shit done, solving problems, not waiting for someone else to solve a problem, right? That type of attitude is quite rare in policy circles. It's very rare in government, in my experience. And so it's something that really sets you apart and allows you to create trust and to do stuff that's quite impactful. And so I think that kind of entrepreneurial attitude that I take for granted is something that in a sector where it's not very common actually makes a big difference.
I think from that perspective, it's almost like this perfect bridge between, you know, founders and policymakers, you sitting in the middle, you know, how things work on, you know, both sides of the table and how to get best outcome for the task at hand. Your role as a policy advisor is not necessarily helping people stay on top of what's going on, but it is most impactful for you to go and become proactive, help shape policy. How much of a difference from your experience does becoming proactive make? You can give examples if you have any, or more broadly, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about policy, kind of processing policy and feeding it back into a company's strategy and planning is just the first step. It's an essential first step, but just the first. Then what you really want to do is influencing. And I think a very nascent industry like the carbon removal industry is actually a great place for that because the rules are being written as we speak. But the effort required is massive. My personal approach is heavily networking based. Again, I could spend an episode probably talking about how I like to do policy. It's a bit unconventional, but it's very much focused on kind of high frequency networking and the use of social media. But when I think of an example, you know, when I joined the Chancellery, there was a big piece of EU regulation that had just come out, and it didn't include kind of the technological, very progressive technological approach to digital identity at the time that the government in Germany wanted, and that I also believed was best for the 400 million Europeans in the future. And so it was really about getting that methodology, that technical approach into this piece of regulation. Often that's just a few words. Sometimes it's a paragraph. It's small things on the surface, but it makes a huge difference when it comes to implementation. And again, that worked out, took a year and a half, took infinite amount of networking, hundreds of calls, but eventually it worked out.
You spent some time in crypto, and that's obviously super exciting space as well, massive tailwinds too. And then you moved into carbon removal, or more broadly, climate space. How did that transition happen? What was your decision-making process? And also, did you do any prior work in climate tech?
No, actually, I didn't. I spent around 10 years in the digitization space, and that's a booming industry as well, like especially with COVID. Governments were scrambling to provide services digitally to their citizens. And so some might say it was a very bad time to leave. But for me, while impactful, it wasn't what I wanted to do for the next 20, 30 years. And I've always been kind of eyeing up the climate space because I'm hugely passionate about nature. That's where I spent most of my time. And I actually got into it through another podcast that I'd like to give a shout out by Naeem Merchant called The Carbon Curve. And I used to work with Naeem in international development, but he made the transition to carbon removal before me. He has a podcast and I was listening to it on one of my runs. And I was like, wow, I knew climate tech is already my passion because it's kind of the intersection of, you know, climate technology, two things I love. But when I heard about carbon removal, I had this aha moment, you know, the light bulb turned on and I was like, did I not know about it? How is this not a much bigger thing? I started reading up on it and I realized that, this is probably going to be huge. You know, the IPCC says without carbon removal, we cannot hit any of the 1.5 degree, if not 2 degree scenarios. So it's this thing that, you know, the biggest scientific consortium on climate says we absolutely need, yet it's currently just a drop in the ocean. So my conclusion from it was, it's going to be huge. You want to jump on the train now. Obviously, time will tell. But yeah, I'm super excited about the space and I decided to make a full transition to it.
And what's your assessment of the space so far from a policy perspective, to the point that we briefly discussed in the beginning, that gap between the technology or builders of it and the policymakers? Where does it stand right now?
So if you think about kind of the life cycle of a human, I would say we're barely past newborn right now. It's very, very, very early days for the market, but also for policy. I kind of focus on three major areas, the UN, the US, and the EU. The UN is fairly high level. It's super interesting work. They're trying to establish how governments can achieve their net zero claims and essentially trade carbon credits between them. But it moves very slowly. So it's something that I'm following, but that I expect will take a couple more years to come to a point where I want to engage more. The US last year was a crucial year. It passed the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, and it also passed the Inflation Reduction Act, two bills that together will invest hundreds of billions into climate tech and renewables, which is just massive. And they're essentially taking a capital money first approach. So the challenge from a policy perspective is actually making sure that that money gets to the right places, which is very different to what you have in the EU. The EU is taking a completely different approach, which is let's first clarify what we're talking about. Let's first create some definitions. Let's first say what a carbon removal is, and then slot it into existing regulations and channel capital to it. I think we need all of that. So I'm very happy that we have these different approaches. And again, I'm getting involved. I have my hands in all of them, hopefully. In terms of the connection between builders and policymakers, I think it's pretty solid. Like, again, maybe because I came from the opposite other end, because crypto is pretty extreme in this way, that there's a huge gap, that my job for 2 years was just bridging that gap. That's literally all I did. And whereas here I realized there are already a lot of connections between policymakers and entrepreneurs, technologists. And so I think there's a good information exchange already happening. And the challenge is more finding agreement in a very nascent industry. You know, everyone's trying to say what a standard is. Everyone's trying to be the first mover and kind of creating a shared understanding is the challenge.
So the US announced these two super critical legislations, which will now funnel hundreds of billions of dollars, as you just said. And EU, there was this Repower EU scheme, right? A similar idea to IRA, but it needs to be boosted further to be comparable. But at the end of the day, even though sort of these jurisdictions are racing with one another, CO2 emissions is something global. So the fact that US could achieve certain improvements within their geography doesn't solve the global problem. How should we think about interoperability between these different jurisdictions, almost like level setting, you know, these different agendas and big legislations that support the sector?
I think they feed off each other. I think historically, if you look at different areas of technology, you've kind of always had the EU being the standard setter, the regulator, kind of leading the way on regulation and setting groundbreaking regulation like the GDPR in the data and privacy space, right? That has been emulated by jurisdictions all over the world. And you've got the US, which has always been the primary investor, channeling subsidies, but also creating big capital markets for technology. And I think they feed off each other. And I think it's quite healthy that we have these two. And what I see happening is the EU is playing catch up now to match the investments that are happening in the US. And the US is, I wouldn't say playing catch up with the regulation. They're more kind of observing and probably waiting for the EU to do their thing, but definitely being on standby. And so I see a lot of complementarity between these two spaces. And again, as I said earlier, I think it's great that we have two different approaches by two of the biggest markets, because yeah, we need to try everything we can. And so yeah, all approaches are welcome.
Is it then fair to say that these two are converging to each other?
I wouldn't go that far, because one example is we have a compliance market for carbon credits in the EU, which we might talk about later, the EU ETS, it's called, Emission Trading Scheme. It's huge. It's the biggest compliance market in the world. It can play a massive role when it comes to something like carbon removal in the future, not today, but in the future. But that's a stick approach, right? Europe likes to use a stick. The US likes to use a carrot. And I don't see the US using a stick anytime soon when it comes to this, right? So I don't think that they will necessarily converge, that the US is going to put on like a massive compliance market tomorrow. But I think some things will cross the pond.
I remember 15 years ago now, when I was working in a renewables company, we were actually operating in that EU ETS scheme. We had our wind and solar power plants, hence generating credits, which we could sell into that scheme. But it's a shame from that time to today, that market has not grown significantly, unfortunately, right? And now we are talking about voluntary carbon markets, but it is tiny. Should we talk about that? What's the right way to think about the carbon removal space as to the size of the market?
And maybe if you don't mind, I'll quickly explain what a carbon removal is, because we haven't actually done that. And there's a lot of misunderstandings. So a carbon removal literally means that you capture atmospheric CO2. As many of your listeners will know, we have a ton of CO2 that's already out there. So even if we cut all emissions tomorrow, we'd still be warming the climate. And so CO2 removal means you capture atmospheric CO2 and store it for X amount of time. And I'm sure we're going to talk about permanence, but that's kind of the concept, right? Whereas carbon capture and storage, which is often kind of a bit confused with it, is when you take CO2 from a fossil source, think an industrial process, you know, you create energy, you create chemicals, you create steel, cement, that emits a ton of CO2 that otherwise would not have been emitted if it hadn't been for that industrial process. And if you capture that CO2 and you put it back underground, you have a net neutral process at best, right? Like without the production, there wouldn't have been an emission. So one is net neutral, one is net negative. So I think that's important to understand when we're talking about removals, that it's a net negative process for the climate and not the same as that net neutral carbon capture and storage process. But coming to how to think about the market, you already touched on it, right? There's a compliance and a voluntary market. I think that's a good place to start. The compliance market is most advanced in Europe through the EU ETS. It's currently only focused on fossil production, essentially, fossil fuels, but it's being expanded to other heavy emitting industries. And in future, it could be expanded to even more industries, right? So that's a huge vehicle. It's in the tens of billions of euros. And that is honestly where I hope we will go. But currently, it doesn't include carbon removals. It's important to note, it does not include carbon removals. It just includes these net neutral offsets. The removals market is, as you said, it's tiny. I know the 2021 figure was 2 billion euros. It's supposed to be around 3 to 4 in 2022. I haven't seen the figures yet. So it's growing rapidly. And at this rate, it will become huge, but it's still in the single digit billions, right? And within that voluntary market, the percentage of high quality, and again, I'm sure I'm going to talk later about what I mean with that, but high quality carbon removal, the good stuff, the gold standard, the stuff that I think we need to scale massively, that is less than 1%. So it's a drop in the ocean right now, which is kind of what I said at the beginning. I can't believe it is a drop in the ocean, given how important it is for the climate and for humanity, but we need to scale it a lot from where it is today.
I think this is a good point to talk about different technologies and to define what high quality carbon removal is, because there is a lot of greenwashing and it is hard to separate one from another if you don't really know the specifics. What different technologies exist in carbon removal, which one we categorize at high quality, which one not. Also the criteria set, you mentioned one of them, permanence, just a minute ago, but I think there is more.
Very happy to. And my focus is, as I said, on kind of carbon removal. And there, I actually think the single metric we need to use is permanence or durability. It's synonymous. Essentially, when you capture a ton of CO2, how long do you store it away for? Is it 5 years? Is it 50? Is it 100, 1,000, 10,000? There's a huge difference between them. Unfortunately, we treat, especially financial markets, like to treat carbon credits like a fungible token. It's not, right? Like a 5-year credit is no way comparable to a 10,000 year credit. But because at the moment we don't differentiate, yeah, it creates a lot of mess. But let's take permanence, durability as the main criteria, because I think that's the key. High quality for me is anything that stores carbon roughly in the timescales that CO2 stays in the atmosphere. So we're talking about, you know, 1,000+ years, at least a couple of centuries, but usually thousands of years. And when you think of the technologies, there's a bunch. So on the less durable side, you've got things like afforestation, reforestation, right? Planting of trees. You've got soil carbon and like agricultural practices that store more CO2 in the soil. Those are examples of low durability. You know, we're talking about potentially decades. If there's a wildfire unexpectedly, potentially even less. But we still need it. And this is, I think, one of my takeaways. Like, we need all of it, but we should recognize that the value to the planet is smaller than some of the higher durability stuff. So afforestation, reforestation, soil carbon is on the one side. And then as you move into the higher durability stuff, you've got things like direct air capture and storage, right? That essentially takes atmospheric air through big filters and puts it ideally underground. You've got bioenergy carbon capture and storage, which produces energy from organic biomass and also stores away carbon dioxide that is produced in the process. You've got rock weathering, which is a bit newer, a bit more experimental still, but it's the idea of spreading volcanic ground rock on big surface areas and accelerating the natural process of carbon capturing that exists in nature with these volcanic rocks. And then the one that we are quite focused on, which is biochar created through pyrogenic carbon capture and storage, which is this really ancient, that's why we know it lasts for thousands of years, this really ancient process of essentially heating up organic matter at high temperatures, 500 plus degrees, without oxygen. And that creates this kind, it looks like charcoal, but it's highly condensed carbon that from a chemical perspective is very stable and that has side benefits for agriculture and so on. But you've got those. And then maybe the last category is kind of ocean mineralization, ocean approaches, which again are really up and coming. There's a lot of investment going into it, but are still a little bit less established than the others. But those are kind of some of the approaches. And again, as I said, I would draw the line with hundreds of thousands a year of durability for high quality.
The big discussion would be how costly is it to implement these different technologies and then to scale them? So if you think about the example of a rooftop solar panels in the renewable sector, it's not something new. 15 years ago, that was not even near the point of scalability from a unit economics perspective. And since then, solar cost curve declined 90%. Hence, you know, there are all these companies doing that. How should we think about it for carbon removal space?
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that like the, you know, the buyers of carbon removal are mainly companies with net zero claims, right? And at the moment, because these carbon credits seem to be fungible on the market, where do they go? They go for the cheapest stuff, right? Why wouldn't they? If they all look the same, why would they spend 10 or 100 times more on one credit versus another? So that's why we really need differentiation. Because the cheapest carbon removals, if you think about afforestation, reforestation, for example, you know, you can get some for $10, $20, $25 per ton. On the other end of the spectrum, the most expensive, you know, direct air capture tons at the moment can be $1,500, $2,000. So you're talking about, you know, 100x between them. Then you've got things in the middle, like biochar is probably the most affordable, durable carbon removal. And I think the last stat I saw was $150 on average dollars per ton last year. So you've got a big range. What we need is economies of scale, right? Like at the moment, why is direct air capture so expensive? It's because it's infancy. Once we see, and it can have huge economies of scale in the future. So there's a lot of parallels drawn to the cost of a kilowatt hour of solar energy, right? And I saw a stat yesterday again, which was like, you know, it went from hundreds of dollars to a couple of cents. I think we can achieve that in the high quality carbon removal space, but it will require significant investments in economies of scale.
Absolutely. And we talked about IRA Act, hundreds of billions of dollars, right? It sounds a lot, but still, in order to get to net zero targets, we need to spend way more than that, a couple of trillions dollars per annum. We should now talk about carbon future. So how would you explain what carbon future does?
So as you said in the intro, kind of carbon future is the operating system for high quality carbon removal. And what that means is it provides all the services that suppliers, so producers of carbon removal and buyers of carbon removal need to, you know, get off the ground. So from a supplier side, you know, you need financing, you need tools for monitoring, reporting, and verification. You need access to standards, to buyers. From a buyer's perspective, you need trust, you need transparency, you need clear pricing. So we essentially build various tools and services that provide suppliers and buyers with everything they need.
When you decided to go into climate space as a policy advisor, what made you pick Carbon Future and how would you differentiate one platform from another in where Carbon Future operates?
Yeah, I think for me, there were a bunch of reasons, probably three reasons, and one actually answers your question. I would say the first reason for me was I didn't want to be pigeonholed too much. I want to push the entire sector. I don't want to push just a specific technology, right? And what I like about Carbon Future is any high quality carbon removal is in our interest. And so from a policy perspective, I can push for all of high quality carbon removal. And while I love all these individual technologies, I quite like being able to push the sector as a whole. The second, I've seen a bunch of companies in my life. I've run a bunch of companies. I can tell a good from a bad entrepreneur, I think, at this point. And I just really like the team. There's kind of a certain maturity and experience in the team that I find really comforting. You know, the idea, I used to be the workaholic entrepreneur who worked 80 to 100 hours a week. I think that's bullshit, to be honest. And now what I like is I appreciate an entrepreneur who pushes hard, but also appreciates balance. And I think that's something that I really value in Carbon Future. And the final one, and that answers your question and kind of differences between, there are a number of companies that are basically doing parts of what Carbon Future is also doing, right? And what I like about Carbon Future is it's playing the long game. To give you an idea, if we talk about standards, I can go into more detail, but there are no standards right now, or there's very few emerging standards in the carbon removal space. So there's a temptation to just define yourself what is good, what is a good carbon removal as a marketplace. And then if people fit your profile, fit your standard, you start selling their credits. But in the long term, to me, there's a bit of a conflict of interest. If you define what's good, you certify it, and then you sell it. What I liked about Carbon Future is they were like, look, we're only going to sell whatever can be certified by a third party. So if there's a third party standard that people can comply with, then we're willing to put them on our platform and sell their credits. And I like that approach because for me, that creates more trust. And while it might be slower in the short term, it might get less supply onto the platform today. I think over 3, 5, 10 years, this is the model that will win. And that's why, I was drawn to Carbon Future.
Awesome. Great. And you mentioned 80 to 100 hours that an entrepreneur would spend a week. I like your approach there. Perhaps we should do another podcast in the coming months, which is Life of an Entrepreneur, something like that.
I can talk for hours about that. So, yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. If you were to describe how you get new suppliers onto the platform from the perspective of why they choose to work with you among different other options, how would you do that?
So first, I think it's helpful to understand what do these suppliers look like, right? If you think about suppliers for something like BEX or DAX, which I mentioned earlier, they tend to be really big, right? Like they need infrastructure, they need pipelines. Like these are not your small decentralized startups, right? They tend to be big companies. So they are a little bit outside of kind of where we can add most value. We want to work with them in the future, but they already have access to financing. They're often collaborating with big companies, right? Whereas if you think about things like biochar, you might have folks that are already sitting on a ton of biomass, right? From agricultural processes, for example. They might be rice producers in Southeast Asia. They have a ton of rice hulls that they just burn after they harvest. And we need to get those people on board that are kind of all over the world, that are sitting on a ton of biomass, and that we can tell them, look, actually this waste product of yours, that can help us save the planet and you can make money from it. And so these are the suppliers that we really want to get onto the platform. And I think how we do that, a key thing for them is financing, right? And getting paid for what they're doing. And very often the process of getting paid for your credits can take a long time. So most marketplaces, you can, you know, sign up as a supplier, you can find buyers yourself. And we offer this service. Like if you want, you just sign up on the platform, you find a buyer. And whenever you have a transaction, the buyer might pay you 6 months, 12 months later. We do that, but the alternative we do, which suppliers seem to like a lot, we just pay you straight away, right? Like we buy your credits straight away, and then we deal with everything that comes after, with kind of finding the right buyers, the transactions, all of that, which means as a supplier, you get paid and you can keep moving. You don't have to wait. And so I think that's a key benefit, is to offer both options. More mature suppliers might go straight to the buyer. Less mature suppliers might prefer to have us as an intermediary to get off the ground quicker.
If you go to the other side of the table, the demand side, right? So big corporates are on this, they go buy these carbon credits, but not all of them are at the same level of sophistication or attention. So how do you get new buyers into the space, onto the platform?
This is critical. This is one of the biggest bottlenecks the industry faces right now. I saw the stat that last year you only had 20 odd companies buying more than 1,000 tons of high quality carbon removal. And that's nothing. That's like, we need thousands of times this, right? And there's a reason for that. I mean, I saw recently, for example, even the term green hushing is now becoming more normalized, right? Because a lot of companies that are moving first get thrashed in by the public and in the media because something went wrong with their projects, right? Sure. And so a lot of companies either don't enter the space or play it very under the radar, right? And so what do we need to do? I think we need to do a bunch of things. You know, the first thing is we need to reduce fear. We need to make sure that these companies know that they're getting into something reliable that has a very low reputational risk. And again, that's why I said, why, you know, my third reason for picking Carbon Future, kind of this long-term game with relying on third-party standards, all of that, it's all about reducing the risk for reputational damage for buyers. And I think that's critical, is reducing that fear. The second one, which is linked but different, it's increasing transparency, you know, when it comes to pricing, to volumes, to working with third-party platforms like CDR, FYI, big shout out to them, they're amazing, but providing them with data, creating transparency so that buyers can understand what's going on and what exactly they're getting into is key. And the third one is we need to create more appetite, is almost kind of using a carrot for these buyers, right? They like telling them the story of what being a first mover can mean for them, right? Like if they have to get in eventually, all of these companies have made net zero claims by 2050. There might even be compulsory requirements by governments in the future. So you might as well get in now. If you get in now, you can be a first mover. You can get the reputational gains from being a first mover. You can, you know, you can shape the industry. So I think kind of creating that appetite is also really important. But yeah, all of that is stuff we do day in, day out, and we need to get more buyers into the space.
I'm always interested to understand the scale of the business that we're talking about. So how do you define the current reach of Carbon Future? And I'm also interested to understand what is the North Star metric that you guys have at Carbon Future?
The North Star metric is pretty simple, which is deliver tons of high quality CO2 removal, right? As long as we make sure, which we do, that these tons are high quality and pass a certain quality threshold, all that counts is scaling that up. Last year, that was 2022, that was 37,000 tons, but we're expecting significant growth. So exponential growth on this front. I mean, we announced, for example, deals, a 50,000 ton deal late last year with MASH. So there's a bunch of really interesting deals in the pipeline on that front, but that's the key metric. In terms of size, Carbon Future raised its seed round last September. It's now around 30 people, growing very rapidly. And yet this year, we'll see us doubling down on that investment. So yeah, that's where we stand.
Great. Maybe a good place to conclude as we're approaching the end of the podcast. As a senior policy advisor at Carbon Future, as someone who is talking to a bunch of different people every day from different parts of the industry, what do you think is missing in carbon markets today? What are you going to work on in 2023, mm-hmm. now that we are in the beginning of the year?
So I think the single most important thing we need in this industry is scale, right? How do we achieve scale? By driving capital into it. And now if I think, what can I do to facilitate this? It's working on the regulatory framework, because that creates trust and drives investment, right? So if investors, VCs, private equity firms, buyers, advanced market commitments, if they know what exactly the rules are that everyone's playing by, and that they will play by not just now, but in the next 20, 30 years, that will drive investment. And so I'm particularly excited about the EU's carbon removal certification framework, bit of a mouthful, CRCF, which is essentially, to my knowledge, the first attempt at this scale to define what a carbon removal is and how to differentiate between the different types of carbon removal qualities that we discussed, right? Because they're not fungible. And once we have that in place, we have this building block that can be slotted into all other EU regulations. And I think it's going to have a huge impact. And so this year is a big year for the CRCF, for this framework, and I'll be focusing a lot on that with the hope that that can drive scale in the sector.
This has been a fascinating conversation to go into the specifics of the carbon removal market from a policy perspective and technology perspective. Thanks again for making the time. But my closing question for everyone is this: what are you most curious about these days, and what are you doing to learn more about it?
I'm a very curious person, and I find clean tech a rabbit hole, because clean tech has so many interesting dimensions. When I think about the novel production of materials, production processes, renewables, it just artificial meats, that it just doesn't end, right? And I love binge listening podcasts on clean tech, and I have to fight every urge to get involved, because I need to focus. That's the only way to really have an impact. But I could get involved with so many initiatives there. So yeah, clean tech is a incredible space that I'm very curious about and learning very actively.
Awesome. Thank you for coming to the Curious Learners. I really love the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.